يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام.
You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series from the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. Hello and welcome to Middle East Analysis, and I know you haven't heard this for a while, and there are several reasons for that. But today it's time for us to focus yet again on the Middle East, and to do so I'm joined by our consultant on the region, that's Dr. Harry Hagopian. Now, this is actually a very special Middle East Analysis, because not only is it the first one in 6 weeks, but We have a new home, which is on www.catholicnews.org.uk, so bookmark that if you will. And crikey, Harry, I don't really know where to start, literally, because I can ream them off. Libya with an interim prime minister and all that's happened there with Colonel Gaddafi and so forth. Syria, we have President Bashar al-Assad talking about a number of Afghanistans if there's intervention in that area. I mean, I could go on and on. Elections in Egypt and in Tunisia, which you're going to talk to us about. Israel, Palestine, bid for statehood. Stop me. Help me. Where do we start,
Harry?
Good
morning to you and to your listeners. And congratulations on your new home, James. I know you worked very, very hard to get that new home ready. So it's a pleasure to be back with you. You've been busy. I've been busy with my travels. So let's try and have a quick look at some of the key points in some of those countries in the Middle East and North Africa region, and perhaps take it from there.
Well, you're going to have to help me pick the bones out of this huge list I have in front of me. Now, the eyes of the world are on the region. We don't need to say that.
Sure.
So shall we start with Libya, Syria, Lebanon? Let's look at that grouping. And since we last spoke, what on earth has happened?
That's true. Well, as far as Libya is concerned, things are looking up a bit. Since we last spoke, as many of our listeners would know, and some of them saw those gruesome pictures on their television screens, Colonel Muammar Gaddafi was caught hiding in a drainpipe, and he was, in my opinion, summarily executed. And then there was a lot of discussion about what to do with the body because of respect for Muslim rights, but also because of the strength of feeling amongst Libyans against him after 40 plus years of a pretty despotic autocratic rule. Eventually, they decided to bury him in an unmarked grave. And so, since that has happened, it's almost as if Libya has taken the first step toward a new beginning. And that new beginning, hopefully, will be followed up by various concrete steps. The first one was already taken. A new interim prime minister, as you mentioned in the intro, has been elected. Now he's a technocrat. He's open to the West. He's accepted by most Libyans. And the idea, that is, he will prepare the country for what we would understand as parliamentary elections within the next 8 months or so. And hopefully that will be one way for the country to start getting back on its feet again. Interestingly enough, because Libya, unlike, say, Syria, is so rich with oil that companies are literally rushing there, trying to get their deals signed up so that before anybody else comes in and moves in, so everybody's after a slice of the cake. But at the moment, Libya is, I don't know whether to call it a positive scenario within the revolutions and popular revolts of the country, but it certainly is not the most worrying at this very moment.
Well, I don't want to dwell on this, Harry, but you mentioned the problem, if you like, of what to do with the body of Gaddafi, and we saw that with bin Laden, didn't we? And then also the echo with Saddam Hussein as well. Mm-hmm. As you know, are you going to turn the burial area into a shrine? And the awful images, I thought, actually, of execution, if you like, however we term it.
Yep.
It's very unsatisfactory, despite the acknowledged brutality of the man.
It's very unsatisfactory. I had a lot of problem with that, and I was asked many times, James, whether I approved of the way he was summarily executed and then buried or not. Well, the reason they've buried him in an unmarked grave, you hit the point when you said they want to avoid his burial place becoming a shrine, and then that would foment more trouble in the future. Not forgetting that Libya is a tribal country, and some of those tribes still have some loyalty to him, either by blood or by marriage. And therefore, this is one way for the National Transitional council to try and avoid that problem. However, the manner of his killing was quite gross. It was not right. And interestingly enough, a lot of people I've spoken to have said, isn't it convenient that he died rather than be tried either in Tripoli in Libya or at the International Criminal Court in The Hague? Because if the bird started singing, as we say, then a lot of secrets will have come out that might have embarrassed not only Libyan officials who are now in positions of authority, but also many, many Western leaders and any other leaders of the world. So in a sense, it suited pretty much everybody's purpose for this man to die and his secrets to die with him. However, in terms of justice, I would have, as a lawyer, but also as somebody who would disapprove of this kind of summary execution, I would have very much wanted him to be caught and tried rather than buried. But what I also say, let's understand the anger of the moment and let's go beyond it, because it's part of the past now and we should focus on the future.
Well, I agree, we should go beyond that. And obviously our prayers are with the reconstitution of Libya and ongoing.
Of course it is.
Can we move on now to Syria? Mm-hmm. And the last... when I was keeping abreast of the situation, I was still quite shocked by the rhetoric coming from President Bashar al-Assad. You know, it was that pointed finger, that warning, if you intervene, you're going to have 10 Afghanistans on your hands. What's your
take?
It
was a very interesting interview that he gave with Andrew Gilligan for the Sunday Telegraph, in which he basically threatened that if you try to mess with me too much, the whole region will either explode or implode, depending on how you look at it. And to some extent, I think that is scaremongering. I think the regime is in a very bad shape. I think it's in a corner. I think it's incredible. If there's one thing I find fascinating, it's the stamina, the tenacity, the persistence of all those demonstrators in places like Homs, like Hama, like Idlib, like Daraa, like Deir ez-Zor, in different parts of the country every day demonstrating, despite the fact that they're being confronted not only with live bullets, but with tanks and cannons and sometimes even helicopters. And yet they're out in the streets demonstrating, asking for an overthrow of the regime. Now, two things that we should take into account. One is the Arab League, which I've always said is pretty much a dormant international organization, has suddenly woken up to some extent, and it has this initiative on the table which calls upon the Syrian authorities and the government to withdraw all armed presence from the different cities in Syria, to release the 70,000 odd prisoners that are now lurking in Syrian jails in what I would consider pretty miserable conditions, and also to make sure that there is a dialogue between the Syrian National Council, which is this new umbrella that supposedly represents the opposition, and the regime of President Bashar al-Assad. Now, that happened about a week ago, the initiative, and the hope was that the Syrian regime would respond to it and there would be some dialogue which would lead toward a better future for Syria, perhaps parliamentary elections and then presidential elections which would be freer and more democratic. Unfortunately, what has happened is that the regime is continuing is ferocious attacks. I mean, some of the photos I see and some of the people who talk to me about what's happening in the country, it's incredible. I mean, this is an all-out war. The army is fighting the people. And of course, there are dissensions within the army. That's happening, not so much as some people would hope it would happen, but there are some cracks in the army. However, there is this confrontation. The Syrian National Council, which is supposed to be the representative of the opposition, in itself has not yet got a unified voice as what the alternative would really be. But we are at a stage at the moment where the regime wants to stay put, where the National Committee or the opposition wants the regime to go, and the Arab League is in the middle, caught between two equally powerful forces within the Arab world, because some Arab countries want the regime to stay and are supporting it, others want the regime to go and are supporting the opposition. In the process, those who are getting killed are the demonstrators. UN estimates now are well over 3,500 deaths already since the uprising started 7-8 months ago. And of course, those demonstrations and the military response to them is also having an unsettling impact on next door neighbor Lebanon.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. Obviously, we've got the large Maronite community in Lebanon. What is the impact on them?
Well, it's not only upon the Maronite community, James. It's upon the whole country, because Lebanon at the moment is basically pretty much divided between half and half between those who are supporting the uprising and the revolutions and popular revolts and those who are with the regime. And it is quite clear that the government in force at the moment in Lebanon, headed by Prime Minister Najib Mikati, who incidentally was in London only a couple of days ago and he met with our Prime Minister David Cameron, the government at the moment, which includes representatives from Hezbollah, which includes representatives from the Shiite Amal movement, which includes people from General Michel Aoun's Movement for Change, which is a Christian movement, they're all appearing to be supportive of the Syrian regime. Those who are against it are people like the Lebanese forces by Dr. Jaja, those of Saad al-Hariri's Future al-Mustaqbal movement. So the country is pretty much divided into two halves. And Lebanon is a very, very fragile country. And we've always known that when Syria sneezes, Lebanon catches a cold. And what is happening at the moment politically is that the repercussions of the violence in Syria, and abominable violence at that, are also beginning to impact tensions and relations within Lebanon, not least because of the Syrians who live in Lebanon or those who are fleeing the border into Lebanon, and some of them are being welcomed, others are being detained and turned back.
Middle East analysis on catholicnews.org.uk.
Let's now, Harry, move round a bit back towards Libya, stopping off at Egypt and Tunisia. Mm. Now, both those places, you know, we covered this right at the start of the Arab Spring.
We did.
When we were talking about the Arab Spring.
We did. Who would have thought, James, that one man, unknown to the whole world, in a little village, unheard of by the whole world, would spark off a huge, huge paroxysm of change in the whole region?
Well, the mind boggles, but we have actually in, you know, almost a year come round to that point now, already in Tunisia and coming up in Egypt, and I will ask for your expert opinion on this. We're getting now parliamentary presidential elections. We're, dare I say, a fresh start, dare I say, a new political landscape. And tell us a bit about that landscape.
It is a new political landscape that is defining itself. I think Tunisia is very interesting. Some people were disappointed with the results of the parliamentary elections. Others were not, because they looked at it as a show of democracy at work. And let me explain why. Over 40% of the votes went to the Ennahda party led by Ghannouchi in Tunisia. The Ennahda is an Islamist party. And those who are worried about what an Islamist party would do in terms of freedoms, in terms of fundamental rights, in terms of women's rights, were clearly uncomfortable with what happened in terms of the outcome of those elections in Tunisia. However, another way of looking at it is to say that if 40% of the votes was won by an Islamist party, a Nahda party, it means then that more than 50% was won by non-Islamist parties. So in a democracy, you don't always get what you want, and certainly not in a MENA democracy, because the whole region is not used to democracy, is not used to understanding those values the way we have understood them in the West. Not easily either. I mean, remember all the revolutions and all the bloody fights we've had in the West until we have come to where we are today. And in that sense, the birth pangs in the Middle East are being felt across the region. And so in a sense, I would say that, yes, it might have an Islamist flavor to it. But interestingly enough, Ennahda party is aligning itself with the Takattul party, which is a left-of-center secular party. Now, whether it's doing that for cynical reasons or whether it's doing that for pragmatic reasons, the fact of the matter is, yes, we have to be vigilant. One word that constantly comes up in my own head for the whole region, James, is the word vigilant. We cannot presuppose what's going to happen because we have no precedent. The Arab awakening, as I call call it, has been called for by Arab intellectuals and thinkers for decades. And everybody had almost given up on the region waking up and reclaiming its citizenship rights and its dignity and its human rights. Finally, it's done it. It's very costly. It's very bloody. It's very difficult. Some Christians, indigenous Christian communities there, are afraid. They're paying the price, perhaps, because they worry that a rise in Islamism might not be conducive to a comfortable witness and existence for them. Others are not so worried at all, but it's a region in ebullition. And therefore, what I would say is that we need to ride the crest of the wave rather than try and oppose it, because by opposing it, we might actually be crushed in the process.
Now, I'm not sure a podcast of this nature, one of our Middle East analysis podcasts, has ever gone by without you using the phrase, "I am not a prophet." So I'm actually going to give you a chance to use that by talking specifically about Egypt. And we've talked about the rise of Islamism and perhaps the natural rise, yeah, considering what's going on. Would you like to try and be a prophet to say what might happen in these presidential and parliamentary elections in that country?
Let me try to be a kind of a pseudo-prophet. And some people would then say he got the wrong conclusions, therefore he's a false prophet. And I'm willing to live with that, James. In Egypt, I think the situation is much more serious than we realize. Your listeners will have been aware that 2-3 weeks ago we had violent clashes in Maspero Square near the National Television building between Coptic Christians, who are Egyptian citizens, and the security forces. And much ink was spent, including incidentally mine on my website, trying to analyze why this happened and whether the military council, which is now trying to midwife Egypt into free elections and democracy, whether it had something to do with it or whether it got caught in the middle of this violence between conservative Muslim tendencies and Christian Coptic demands and claims. I think that the sectarian fears are rising in Egypt. I think that the situation is very volatile and very tense. And I unfortunately also believe that the military council in Egypt, like in other parts of the MENA region, Syria could be one example, Yemen could be another, where the leaders, be they the military council, be they the president, be they the government, use the fear or stoke up sectarian fears and tensions so that when the people start fighting each other, they then are looked upon as the saviors of the country rather than the problem in that country. And in a sense, I think the military council would be quite happy to be viewed as an indispensable midwife that stays on after the birth of democracy. And therefore, what they're trying to do is, rather than combat this sectarianism, they are actually perhaps even helping nudge it forward. Now, as you know, and as your listeners would notice, I slowed down because I was trying to choose my words carefully. I think that there is a large presence of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. Some people are afraid of that. I actually am not afraid of the Muslim Brotherhood or Islamism, because it is not the only force in that part of the world. The whole region has been rent open, and in a sense, we have to contend with whatever forces come out. But I also think that if we really believe in a democracy, then we have to live with the expectations of the people, and we need to move forward with them. But in Egypt, there are serious issues. And I think if something is not done about those sectarian tensions, and if we are not vigilant enough to speak out against them, then Egypt, post-parliamentary elections, post-presidential elections, could find itself in as bad, if not worse, situation than it was under Hosni Mubarak.
Dr. Harry Hagopian on Middle East Analysis.
Well, I have to say, Harry, we've touched on a lot of midwifery there, including free election midwifery, which is quite something. I'm sure the National College of Midwives might actually be interested in today's podcast. Is now the time, as we're winding up, Harry, to now talk about Palestine-Israel? You know, we talked, I think our last podcast focused in very specifically on the bid for statehood at the United Nations in New York. now we've had the UNESCO angle. So do you want to tell us a little bit about what's happened there?
The UNESCO vote, which surprised some but not all observers, is basically, in my opinion, and we've discussed this as well, James, is basically an indication of the despair and the frustration of the Palestinian people as a whole to the fact that nothing is moving forward in terms of the settlement of that conflict, in terms of the quartet being pretty much unable to tailor an agreement between the Palestinians and Israel, and the settlements are increasing. There's less land to talk about, and there will come a time when we are talking about slices of a cake that no longer exists on the plate. And in that sense, the Palestinians are pushing. They're pushing in order to show or to force the hand of the international community to act. That is where I think the UNESCO vote is situated. And I believe that personally, this week again, the United Nations statehood bid that the Palestinians have lodged with the Secretary General of the UN will be discussed. I think they will not get the requisite number of votes for it, and I think it will be pushed back. However, the psychological pressure is there, a marker is there, and it's important for us to be involved with the Israel-Palestine conflict for a whole variety of reasons, James, not least because here at the Catholic Bishops' Conference at the International Affairs Department, which incidentally, as you know, is chaired by Bishop Declan Lang, our own bishop in the Clifton Diocese, we basically have a real stake. We are stakeholders in what happens to the Christian communities across the whole region, but specifically also in the Holy Land. And it is important to see that justice finally prevails. And at the moment, unfortunately, there is no justice. We're talking about the popular revolts and revolutions in the whole region. We're now talking about Iran acquiring nuclear arms and therefore what would that do to the region and beyond. We're even talking about the Gulf region where recently Archbishop Patrick Kelly represented the Catholic Church at an interfaith dialogue in Doha in Qatar. We are doing all these things not just to do something, but because it is a way of carrying forward our witness and trying to help sisters and brothers who are there witnessing to their faith, and also making sure that we work for peace and justice. If we do that, if we manage to keep the prophetic voice that we are expected to come out with, then we are doing something right. But if we're doing it simply to go through the motions and nothing else, then it's better if we don't bother at all, because at the end of the day, we lose our credibility, and the people in the MENA region are telling me, hey guys, what are you doing? And when somebody says that to me, a Christian from the region, it pains me if I don't have a specific answer to give them.
Fair point, Harry. UNESCO, I should say, is the United Nations agency responsible for education, science and culture. Apologies for not pointing that out.
And you know, for UNESCO, what I suggested the Palestinians could do now that they're full members of UNESCO, the first thing they should do is they should try and initiate a motion to create some heritage sites in Palestinian-controlled areas. And of course, one of those that I love as a building is the Basilica or the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem, birthplace of our Lord and Savior. If we can do that, then at least we show that there was some practical, concrete result of this whole political brouhaha rather than just going through the motions for the sake of going through the motions.
Well, I'm going to leave that to Dr. Harry Hagopian to table the Palestinian Authority rather than a little old me. So, Dr. Harry Hagopian, thank you very much for your time. It's been a long and winding and interesting roundup of many, many huge issues that really have occurred since we last spoke. So I do appreciate your patience and time with that. Syria, need to look at Syria again. There are a number of things, you know, Yemen. We have plenty to talk about in the coming
weeks.
There
are huge issues that we can still talk about, but we do not want to strain the listeners' patience with a very long podcast. Hopefully we'll do it again, where we can also talk a little bit more, particularly also on what is happening exactly to the Christian communities across the MENA region, the contradictions and the tensions within those communities as a result of those popular revolts, and then look a little bit more ahead to the future. You called me a prophet. I said, let us leave it at pseudo-prophet. Hopefully, we'll be able to continue the conversation, you and I, in the future.
As it always does, time will tell. Thank you, Dr. Harry Hagopian, the Bishop's Consultant on the Middle East. Stick with us on our new home, catholicnews.org.uk.